Welcome to Mac Power Users. I'm David Sparks, and I'm joined, as always, by Mr. Stephen Hackett. Hey, Stephen.
Hey, David. How are you?
Good. We are marching into the future on the Mac Power Users today. We're going to be talking about artificial intelligence. But before we do so, we've got a few announcements. MPU merch is shipping. I just got my notice.
Yeah, me too. I got a t-shirt and a hat on the way. Super excited to get that stuff. So if you've ordered, be on the lookout for an email. I think mine gets here this weekend. So I'm going to be very stylish next week.
Yeah, let us know. Send us your picture. I want to see how it looks. And also, by the way, thanks everybody for all the great feedback on the new kind of brand change with the new logo and the new music. We've had lots of positive, very little negative, and I'm just really happy that people dig it. And it was kind of fun making some changes after all these years.
Today on More Power Users, which is the longer ad-free version of the show that our members get, you can learn more at relay.fm/MPU. We're going to be talking about the iPad event that is now just a couple of days away on the 7th. And we'll be following that up with an episode that we're going to record in the aftermath of that event, looking at the iPad, where it is, because the iPad's kind of been in a weird spot. It seems like there's some exciting stuff really now just a couple of days away.
Yeah. But the topic today is artificial intelligence. And this is one we've had on our radar now for a while. And here we are, man.
Here we are. So I think people know we work on outlines for quite a while. We have been spending time with a bunch of different services, trying to compare them, figure out what's going on. And it is definitely a moment, right? It's like I named the title, the current AI moment, because it is just everywhere. Like, there's no way we can get to everything here. Lots of people have lots of feelings about it. You know, some people are very excited about this future, especially in generative AI, where AI can create content or take existing content and remix it. But obviously, there's also complications and potential downsides there as well. So this is a big, hairy one, y'all. Like, there's a lot of stuff to manage. But what I always come back to is, like, what's the dream of this, right? And I think for me, the dream is having a computer that talks and thinks like a human, but knows everything about me and the whole world, right? Like a super intelligent, super helpful assistant or sidekick or partner that can help me focus on what I'm best at, and it takes stuff off my plate. Not everyone views it that way. Not everyone thinks about it that way. But in my mind, that's sort of the rubric that I kind of filter through. But what about you? Like, when you think about this, when you think about the history of it, you know, what we want from it, where do you land?
You know, I think it's complicated. I mean, we've been hearing about this stuff forever. I mean, I remember watching War Games as a kid, you know, where the computer was a supercomputer that kind of became self-aware and helped us avoid a global nuclear Armageddon, you know, and so it's always been on the back of our minds, you know, through media that computers would get to a point where they could do some stuff like this. But then you overlay that with kind of what I would call the two extremes. The first extreme is like, oh, AI is going to solve all our problems and it's going to take care of everything for us. And we're going to move into a new form of existence with AI. I don't think that's true. But I do think it's going to make a lot of things easier. Like a good example is protein folding. You know, people used to spend their PhDs folding proteins. And if you can fold proteins, you can cure diseases. There's a whole lot of stuff you can do with it. But it takes years and years of effort to fold a protein. And there's thousands of them out there. Maybe hundreds of thousands. Scientists out there are cringing, but the bottom line is they figured out how to teach AI to fold proteins. And over the course of 3 or 4 years, it like folded all the proteins. So one of the reasons why we get, you know, cures and vaccines and things is because AI helped us solve that problem. So there are very good sides to this. Flip side of that is the very bad side. People are like, AI is going to kill us all and it's going to be the end of everything. And I don't know that that's the case. I think it's a technology we should be very respectful of how we use it. I think it's definitely going to disrupt society. I think people are going to lose jobs and entire professions are going to go away and new ones are going to be created. And I don't know how that's all going to shake out. And the fact is I can't control any of that. You know, I can't control either extreme, but what I can say is, as a Mac power user, how can you put this technology as it exists today to use for you? And that's what I've been focusing on. I've been covering it in the Mac Market Labs and just a lot, doing a lot of research, because I think that there are useful tools in AI right now for you. And I'd like to, for the purpose of the show, is avoid those two extreme positions, because that's stuff we're not going to solve here.
Sure.
But I do think there are ways to use it right now on your Mac and your devices to make your life easier.
And I think that's the right way to go about this, right? Because there are very useful tools out there today that we can use in our work that make it more efficient or better or can spark ideas, right? And I think that's much more interesting than like the larger conversations. Like, I'm gonna let people smarter than me handle that. I want to find ways to assist me in what I'm already doing. And
yes,
with that in mind, there are some things, some sort of basic things that we need to sort of lay as the foundation. I think the biggest one is, just because an AI tool says something or creates something doesn't mean that that something is true or accurate.
They call it hallucinations, where it tricks itself.
Yeah.
And it's like the ultimate con man, because with 100% confidence, it tells you an absolute untruth.
Mm-hmm.
And it does it all the time. I mean, the other day, I asked AI about me, and it said that I was the co-host of the popular Mac Break Weekly podcast. I have never been on Mac Break Weekly. I don't know why it thought that, you know, and that is the kind of stuff it does. I don't know where I first heard this idea, but I love it. The idea of, someone said, treat it as an intern. Mm-hmm. Like, you would have an intern do research for you, but you wouldn't publish the intern's research. You would use it as a starting point. And sometimes the interns are really smart and they get it really good. And sometimes the interns are completely, off the grid. Mm-hmm. And AI is like an intern. It can help you, but it's not something you're going to want. You know, it's the saying, trust but verify.
Yeah. Maybe sort of trust, definitely verify.
Yeah. 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 And to go along with that, don't use it for non-verifiable data. You know, mm-hmm. if you can't verify, then you probably shouldn't rely on it. I mean, it's crazy in the legal profession, these people who file legal briefs with AI-generated arguments,
yeah.
and they have like the wrong cases of the wrong decision. These guys are getting disciplinary problems with the Bar Association because they're stupid and they're trusting AI without verifying.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this idea of an LLM has been around a long time, but suddenly they've gotten really good. But how does it work? You know, what is a large language model, and why is it suddenly the new hotness?
It is the new hotness. Boy, you can stick LLM in anything and raise a bunch of money in Silicon Valley. But
let me interrupt you there. Yeah. That is what the reason why this is happening is, mm-hmm. because the money spigots in Silicon Valley for AI are flowing.
Yes. And
even Apple, like, we've talked on this show, I think as recent as like a year ago, where I said, Apple's never going to say AI. They don't want to tie their own version of it to a word that has other meanings. But even Apple has given in, I think, because Wall Street is saying, you don't have an AI plan, we're going to devalue your stock. And so now Apple's all about AI, right? You know, they've been doing it the whole time. They just never wanted to use those words. But now they realize that's the magic incantation to make Wall Street think that you're doing something special.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. So large language models. The easiest way to think about these is, it is a giant collection of information that has been pulled into a supercomputer, basically. And then that data set becomes its knowledge of the world. And out of that data set, it can answer questions, generate text, summarize content, those sorts of things. Now, neither of us are lawyers. I get to say that on the show now. That's fun.
Yeah, neither of us are lawyers.
But the legality and like the complication around this and copyright law, like that's going to be sorted out for years. You're now starting to see companies. I think one of the most famous examples is Reddit. Reddit a couple months ago signed a deal with Google to feed Reddit's user-generated content into Google so they could train their large language models. But a lot of these come from scraping the internet, scraping forums. Like, you and I are in these things, right? There's no doubt about it. Yeah. Because they're fed on information, for the most part, on the open internet.
Yeah, so back then, you know, it seemed like the computer was thinking for itself. All this thing is doing is smashing tokens together, which are, you know, tokens are pieces of words, but it's, you know, read every book and scoured the entire internet. So it's pretty good at predicting which tokens get smashed together. Mm-hmm. It's funny. I actually asked for the outline. I asked ChatGPT, give me an explanation of how LLMs work in no more than 3 paragraphs and keep it simple. And it explained itself pretty good, I thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really, that definition actually is very good that it gives, again, taking in information from books, articles, websites, and then training the computer on that knowledge and then remixing that content. That's sort of the transformer part in GPT is putting that information back together on the other end. And in a way, that's basically how we work, right? Like, I've read a lot of stuff about certain topics, and so I can have conversations about those topics and have my own ideas mixed in with things that I've read. And sometimes I'm quoting something, sometimes I'm not. Like, our brains are basically LLMs. And on the computing side of it, it takes, you know, massive resources, massive amounts of data, massive amounts of hardware. A lot of this happens on like really high-end NVIDIA GPUs. That's a challenge if you're coming like Apple and want to run them locally, which we'll get to at the end of the show. We're going to talk about what Apple is doing and what we think Apple will do. But that's sort of the basis of it, right? Dump a ton of information on a computer, let it process it, and then it can create out the other side.
This episode of the Mac Power Users is brought to you by 1Password, the one-stop solution for security on the internet. Go to 1Password.com/MPU right now and get 20% off. 1Password can take care of you no matter where you are, whether you want a personal account for you or your family, whether you've got a small or medium-sized business and you need a way to protect your people and your data, or even if you go all the way up to becoming an enterprise company and you need the freedom to make big moves without big risks, 1Password is there for you. 1Password gives you what you need when you need it. If you need passwords, they're instant. You need to protect your banking information, credit cards, and software licenses. All that stuff is protected in 1Password. If you want to set up shared password vaults for easy family or team access, they've got that covered too. You can quickly share any 1Password item from your desktop, app, or browser, even with people who don't have 1Password. And the thing I really love about 1Password is that they look to protect me. They monitor and mitigate risks from the outside. If I have a service I have a password for, and that service has had a data breach, 1Password lets me know. It also keeps an eye on my passwords, making sure I'm using good password techniques, not using repeated ones or easily guessed ones. They even go on the dark web and figure out all the hacked passwords, and they compare that list to your password list, so you can make sure none of your passwords are on any published hacked lists. At 1Password, security isn't the feature, it's their foundation. Over the years, I've got to know a lot of people that work there. They are obsessed with protecting you on the internet. When it comes to my internet protection, that's what I want protecting me, obsessive people. Go to 1Password.com/MPU right now, and you'll get 20% off your account. That URL one last time, 1Password.com/MPU. Go there, check it out, protect yourself, your family, and your company. And thanks, 1Password, for all of your support of the Mac Power Users.
Let's talk about some of the companies and platforms that have emerged over the last year or two in this area. And I think we have to start with OpenAI. OpenAI is sort of the leader and the big player here. And I think their ChatGPT service is the one that most people are familiar with.
Well, this is the one that woke everybody up. Like I fully expect that a lot of big companies were running these LLMs internally, but OpenAI made theirs public. And that was a big moment a year and a half, 2 years ago, when they kind of showed up and people realized that these things could write college level papers and things like that. And suddenly everybody had a collective freak out. And that started with OpenAI.
The company OpenAI is like a topic for another day, right? But they have this sort of unusual public-private kind of combination where like they're doing research, but then they're also selling services. Like you can get the newest version of ChatGPT for like $20 a month. But I think you're right. They are definitely the ones that put this on the map of most people. And I think they also set the tone of like how these things work. Like the interface for most of these things is a text box, right? Go to the OpenAI website or I download the ChatGPT app from the App Store. By the way, like there's lots of knockoffs in the App Store. Like you want the official one. A lot of those other apps like charge you additional access fees and stuff that are just on top. If you don't need that, just download their app directly. And I am effectively giving the machine a prompt. So the prompt is like earlier when you said, give me a short explanation of how LLMs work. No more than 3 paragraphs. Keep the explanation simple. That's the prompt. You're asking the computer a question. You're being sometimes very verbose and like what you want. And that can be a way to sort of steer things where you want them to be. You're giving it a prompt. It's doing its thinking in the cloud. And it gives you an answer. But ChatGPT and a lot of these others, that's all within the realm of text.
Yeah, and these are very conversational. Like, and it's I want to say multidimensional, but you can ask it a question, then ask it for refinement of the answer it gives you. About a year ago, I signed up for a paid account for ChatGPT, and I just felt like I'm not really a power user of it, but I just want to be using this. And like I said, I've been making labs videos about it, and I knew we were going to do a show about it eventually. So I chose ChatGPT as my horse for this. I've been testing some of the other services that we're going to talk about here, but this is by far the one I'm most familiar with. And when you pay the extra $20, you get upgraded to version 4, which is a much better improvement. I mean, the quality of the answers you get are much better with version 4. And now apparently version 5 is sometime this summer, last time I heard, so they're constantly pushing down the gas on this stuff. With the paid version, you also get DALL-E, which allows you to make images, which I don't do a whole lot of, and some other extra features, one of which is the ability to create your own GPT, mm-hmm. where you can kind of do custom training. I'll talk later. I did an experiment for the show on that. And these things are definitely, if you're interested in this stuff, I think it's worth paying for it just to kind of start to understand how it works and try to really push it. But if you just want to kind of kick the tires, the free 3.5 isn't terrible either.
No, it's not. It's what's powering a lot of things because ChatGPT and OpenAI's, in addition to having their own products, they are used sort of at an API level for other services. 3.5 is great. At some point they added like history, so you can go back and actually see your previous conversations. So if you want to pick something back up or like, oh, what came out of that? You can look at it. I'm with you. I haven't used a lot of the image creation tools that OpenAI and others have created, but I think out of them, just like ChatGPT is kind of the standard for LLMs, I think DALL-E is sort of the standard for image generation. So again, you're giving it a prompt. We've all seen like the picture, there's a famous picture that went around maybe the end of last year of like the Pope in like a white puffy jacket that DALL-E or some other service had made. But it is really, I want to come back to something you said. It is really conversational in a way that is, I think, different from how we do a lot of our other computing, right? Because you're sending this thing text. You can ask follow-up questions. You can say, hey, actually do that again, but, change a parameter in your prompt. So you know, you said earlier, do it in three paragraphs. You say, actually, that's still too long. Can you give me in two paragraphs? Or could you write an explanation of how LLMs work in iambic pentameter, or, you know, in a poem or something, you know, something like that? It might not do great at the more creative elements, but you can go back and forth with it. And that's where it begins to feel more lifelike in a way that is, like I said, is fundamentally different than a lot of other things I've explored.
Like, here's an example I just put together last night. I have, in the Max Markey Labs, every Friday, I do a podcast. Believe it or not, I have one more, Stephen. But it's like 10 minutes. It's just like this week, I call it the lab report. It's like the news from this week. So the idea is for the members, if they're not, you know, reading all the sites, they can get the lowdown on what's going on in Apple world every Friday. And so during the week, I read articles all the time for this, and I flag them for it. And I made a shortcut that just saves the link, you know, so I've got a bunch of them. So I read them at the time, but then when I go to record it, rather than reading them all over again, I decided, well, I'm going to have it summarize these for me. And hat tip to Damian, one of my members who had the same, who gave me the idea. So I started writing to ChatGPT. I said, you know, here's a list of URLs. Summarize them for me shortly. So I can just once again see a summary of everything I've read. And when I go to record, I've got it in front of me. And I didn't like it. So then I said, well, summarize it into bullet points and then put the title of the article at the top of each one. So this is just natural language, me telling it what to do. Then I give it 20 URLs and it does that, you know? And then I realize, oh, you know, I also need the link because I might want to like give the link into the notes for the podcast. So I said, okay, so first give me the title, then give me the URL link, and then summarize it in five bullet points or less. And I throw 20 URLs at it and it like, bam, it just gives that to you. And then I can just use that when I go to record to have a reminder of everything in the articles. And then I, you know, I go and record my own thing about it. I don't just read the script. I just use that to remind me what the big points were. Mm-hmm. And I put that together in a course of about 30 minutes, but this is absolutely the workflow for this, for me, for this type of work, you know, and just give me a quick summary, give me the link, give me the title. But all of that stuff wasn't through coding. Like historically you would be doing JavaScript or something to, you know, to pull out the link and pull out the article title. And,
yeah,
you know, you'd be organizing it with a computer language, but this is just me telling it in plain language. This is what I want you to do with these links. And it does all that other stuff behind the scenes. And it is using some kind of code to extract all that, but I don't ever hear about it. Mm-hmm. I don't have to program it. It just does it for me.
Yeah. I have a similar example. I may have shared this before, so forgive me, but in the current Apple History calendar in the back, there's a list of every Apple store and its opening date up through the time of publication in the calendar. And I had all that data as a JSON file, but I kind of poked at it with some things. I was like, I basically need to take information out of this. And I want to format it in a specific way. So I want the English name of the store and then the date that it opened formatted like this. And I struggled with it a little bit. And then I was talking to Jason Snell about it. He's like, well, just ask ChatGPT for some code. And so I gave it an example of my prompt, like, this is how the data is structured, but I want it formatted like this. Can you give me something that I can run on my computer that would do this? And it wrote, I think it was in Python. It wrote a Python script that I pointed, you know, in terminal at my JSON file, and it saved a text file on my desktop of exactly what you see in the calendar. That's something that a programmer could do very quickly. In fact, I looked at the Python code. It wasn't complicated, but I'm not that sort of, you know, I'm not in that deep with my development tools. And it allowed me to do something I couldn't do otherwise or couldn't do easily. You know, I could have probably figured it out eventually, but I did it very quickly. And that was a real moment for me of like, oh gosh, like this is extremely useful. But, you know, again, we're not going down the road today, but also like it has ramifications that somebody should be thinking about and talking about. But it was one of those moments like, oh, the computer is helping me do something beyond my own ability. And it was sort of breathtaking.
Okay, let's move on. So OpenAI is the big player here, but yeah. They're not alone. Google is right on their tail. Google has had kind of a confusing story with their AI LLMs, weird. But yeah, it was Bard for a while, and now it's Gemini. But they are definitely in the hunt here.
They are. They're building their own tools. So unlike some others we're going to talk about, this is not OpenAI under the hood. They're building their own, and on the surface of it, it's very much like ChatGPT. It's LLM, trained on lots of data, some of which now Google's paying for, again, like that Reddit deal I mentioned a few minutes ago. But something that's unique to Gemini, best I can tell, is the type of extensions that it offers. And so with the flip of a switch, you can give Gemini in your Google account access to, you know, flight and hotel information, Google Maps information. Like, hey, go out on YouTube, use YouTube as a source. You can also, with certain account types, allow Gemini access to your Google Documents and your Gmail and other content you have in the Google ecosystem. So you're merging, in a way, the LLM with your own data sources. And that gets really interesting, because then you're not only asking an LLM about things on the internet, but you're asking it about things in your own life, data that it has about you. And it's pretty wild. Like, I flipped all the switches in advance of it. I have so many accounts with all these platforms now, it's out of control.
Yeah.
But me too. You know, I flipped all the switches and it's like, oh, this is like, it's in my Google Doc helping me do stuff with text. It can look at Google Maps and YouTube and my Gmail. Like, pretty wild. And I think ultimately Google's on a pretty good path here, that I want these tools, with my permission, to have access to my data, because that's when they're useful, not only for sort of external things, but internal things as well.
I feel like this is where it has to go, right? I mean, to me, you know, staying in that middle space of how can this stuff help me, to me, the ultimate iteration of that is a digital assistant that's like having a personal assistant. Like, if I was, you know, if I was a billionaire, I would absolutely have someone that followed me around, made my appointments for me, scheduled things, dealt with the nonsense email. Just like, I would have all of that, you know, that would be a thing that I would have, a person doing that. But none of us, or most of us, can't afford that. And this is what I think this is meant to be. And I don't think it's as good as hiring someone here in 2024. But in 2027, I don't know. And in order for that to work, it's got to see your data. But in order for it to see your data, you've got to trust it. And so therein lies the rub. And the reason why I think Apple has a tremendous opportunity here. But it is... ultimately, you know, having it go out into the web and summarize an article for me is all fine and dandy. But what I really need it to do is look at my task list and say, well, you keep, you know, deferring this one thing. Maybe you should stop doing that, or, you know, figure out the best way to plan my week. And, you know, just like do stuff for me that is unique to me based on my own preferences.
Yeah.
And that is where I think this needs to get good. Google has a view of this. I think Apple does too. I'm not sure what OpenAI's plan is on this stuff. One of the points I'll make here, gang, is while I've been paying for a bunch of these services, I am paying for all of them monthly. I am unwilling to buy a year of any of these, because things are moving and changing so fast.
Yes.
That I can absolutely see something being, what is it, the bee's knees this month?
And that's what the kids say, 2 months
from now. Yeah, that's what they say. And then like 2 months from now, some other service comes up with something that's better, or it folds into something you already have, or whatever. And so it's very much in motion now, but I'm with you on this whole idea of using my data to serve me better in a way I can trust. But that's the part, which kind of naturally leads us to the next contender here, Microsoft Copilot.
It does. In preparation of this, I actually talked to a good friend of mine who works at let's just say a very large company, right? Sort of Fortune 500 type place. And I knew they were all, they were a Microsoft shop with Office 365. They use Teams, you know, everyone, they're doing OneDrive, the whole thing. And I asked him, I was like, tell me about Copilot. And so Copilot is Microsoft's suite of AI tools. It shows up in a bunch of different features in a bunch of different places. I will give Microsoft credit. Even though the official name is Microsoft Copilot for Microsoft 365, like when it's plugged into your Office applications, it's a bad name. Copilot's a pretty good brand. I think they kind of nailed it on with the word Copilot. Having said all that, it is powered by OpenAI. They have a very large partnership, multi-year, bajillions of dollars. But they're using those things, they're using OpenAI's tools kind of across the Microsoft ecosystem. So it showed up initially in the Bing search engine, which, yes, somehow still exists. But it's also in the Edge browser. And in the browser, it's different than the search engine, right? The search engine is kind of using ChatGPT and OpenAI and some of Microsoft's own stuff on top of search results. In the browser, it can do things like find things in your history or like help bring information from a web page into other places in the Microsoft ecosystem. But the most interesting thing, I think, is Copilot with Microsoft 365. So like we said with Google Gemini, this combines the LLM with data in your organization. Now, Microsoft has lots of controls over what that looks like. And they say some very clear things like your organization's data never leaves your organization. You know, if I point Copilot at an internal Excel sheet, I do not want that data to get sucked into the LLM. And so Microsoft has built walls around it where it can be useful to you in your various contexts, but still private to your organization. And from talking with my friend who has a lot of experience with this and reading a lot about this, it seems like they've done a pretty good job at that. I don't think it's perfect, but they've clearly thought a lot about it. Like, how do we make sure that companies can use this stuff to be more productive, to give their employees new tools, but doing it in a way where you're not leaking a bunch of confidential information? Because obviously that's unacceptable.
Yeah. And like you, I've talked to people. I was tempted to re-sign up for my 365 account, but in the labs, there's several members that are using Copilot regularly. And the general response I got from people who are using it is like, it's a good idea. It's not quite there yet. And I think that may be true for all of these, you know, assistant type technologies. I don't think right out of the box, it is going to be better than the person you hire. But I think that they're all kind of making steps in that direction. And Google, Microsoft, Apple, I think everybody sees the benefit of using user data, but finding a way to do it that's safe.
Yeah, that's definitely the key. And I think Apple's going to have a lot to say about that exact thing. I think Apple, you know, hopefully they don't paint these other things in a light that's not true, but I think they're going to go further than others about separating the AI tool and your data and making it all sort of work the way that people want it to. I'll share one other sort of anecdote of someone, again, talking to my friend, he's got a lot of experience in this, being able to use things like Copilot to do something like what I said earlier about like helping me with a programming issue. Also very useful when you're dealing with sort of IT administration within a 365 organization. So Copilot really is everywhere in the Microsoft ecosystem. It started really kind of first, actually, at least maybe first most famously in GitHub with having Copilot help you with code and code-related tasks in your repositories in GitHub. So all sorts of things. This is clearly a big move for Microsoft. I think it's really interesting that they don't own the technology it's built on, but this huge investment in OpenAI, it's a long-term partnership. Maybe they thought they couldn't buy OpenAI. Maybe they thought that'd be, you know, regulatory issues there they don't want to face. But it is interesting. It's not perfectly in-house, but it does seem like the companies have a very close relationship.
Another one that's more recent is Perplexity. And this is one I'm personally kind of excited about. I've got, I'm sorry to keep talking about the labs, but I just did a video that they'll see on it. And Perplexity, they call it, they try to say that they're competing with Google search engine more than ChatGPT. And it's not a chat thing so much as it is a search engine. And they actually, they're very cute. They call it an answer engine. But it's a different way to search the web. So you go into it, you type your question, and then it goes and searches the web for articles covering the topic that you've asked a question about. Then it gives you a list of all the articles it's reading, and then it composes an answer to your question based on its review of the articles, fully footnoted to the articles, so you can see sources for everything you ask. And I just really started using this in seriously about 2 weeks ago, and now I'm a paying member. This is the best way to search the web, in my opinion. I'm still in the honeymoon period with it. Maybe I'll sour on it, but it is shocking to me, the tests I've done, how good it is. Like I asked it, I have an M1 MacBook Air. Should I upgrade to the current one? I didn't say the M3. I just said the current one. And it figured out that the current one is the M3. And it went and did a full comparison. And it told me, probably not unless you use a lot of graphics. Wow. I mean, it's like, that's a good answer.
It's a pretty good answer.
You know, and then I asked it, what's the best smoothing plane, which is, you know, a very hand tool woodworkers are like very rare. And so I'm thinking, how is it going to know? And it came, it says, you should get the Lee Nielsen No. 3. And I'm like, well, heck, that's actually a very good answer for most people. It's not the one for me. So then I asked it, well, what about low angle? And it said, oh, then you should get the Veritas, which is the one I have. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, and everything was fully footnoted. And I just found it remarkable because, you know, when you think about it, you do a Google search, you want an answer to a question. What the search gives you is the sources where you can find the answer. It doesn't really answer the question. I mean, granted, there are some exceptions, like, you know, what did the Dodgers win? It'll parse that out for you and tell you. But this is like takes it to a whole new level. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, this is the way web search should be. For now on, you know, the robot goes, reads the articles, gives you what it thinks the right answer is, but gives you links to all the sources so you can go check its work. And I'm like, that is impressive. I also did things like, you know, what's the best price on this hand plane? And it found the best price. So it is quite usable for this type of stuff. And I am super interested in this. Now, is Perplexity a separate product in a year, or is that just another function of Google Gemini and ChatGPT? I don't know, you know, but it's certainly an interesting idea, and I'm smitten with this Perplexity service. In fact, I asked you to give it a try. What do you think? Did you kick the tires on it?
Yeah, I did. I think it's super compelling because it is blending live information on the internet, again, with the sources, and the sources are actually above what it says, which I appreciate. ChatGPT and some of the others, they have data that is, it's out of date. You know, sometimes you'll ask ChatGPT something, it's like, oh, well, as of 2022 or whatever. And, you know, that's in 3.5. I think version 4 is more up to date. But Perplexity is not shy. Like, we're just going to merge the LLM and the internet. And that is more up to date and a little bit more interesting. And so I asked it about, I was like, tell me about the Mac Power Users podcast. And it got everything right, including like when Katie announced she was leaving the show, when I joined it, about, you know, sort of what we've done, that it's, you know, been produced over 12 years. And everything that's a fact, it just has a footnote next to it that I can click and go see. And some of the other players, they sort of de-emphasize where the information's coming from. Now, because the internet, it can still get weird. Like Perplexity sometimes pulls from like some user form I've never heard of or a website I've never heard of. But I think out of all of these, this is at this moment, again, things change really quickly. At this moment, I think this is the one that if you haven't played with any of them, I think I'd maybe start with if you want to start playing with some LLMs.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think Perplexity is going to write your scripts for you.
No.
But it is really meant to be a search engine or an answer engine, to use their terminology. And it's a great use of AI. And I really dig it. So that one is probably one of my favorites of the ones we tried for the show.
Me too. I wanted to briefly mention Meta AI. As of this recording, it's still very new. On the website, it's an LLM, right? Like, it's like these other things. I can type to it, ask questions. It can give me ideas. But it's also showing up in Meta's applications. So I think where I have seen it so far is Instagram, where they have replaced the search box in Instagram with a Meta AI text field. So it's using all of its information to help search and surface things within Instagram. It's also going to be rolling out to Facebook and, you know, their other properties over time. And this ChatGPT, OpenAI, making a big splash at the end of 2022 when it was introduced. I think there's a potential for Meta AI to be sort of the second shockwave, because when it's just built into Facebook, like, that's when everyone becomes aware of it, that it is more than a tool where, like, nerdy people may go. But, like, when it's just built into Facebook and Instagram, that's the masses, right? And so I'm very keen to see how that goes.
Well, another point on, and they call it Llama, and it's Llama 3 now is the one rolling out. But the as I understand it, you can download the Llama 3 engine locally and populate it with your own data locally and run, again, giving you the option to run on your own data without necessarily sharing it with Meta or anybody. And I feel almost uncomfortable saying that because I haven't done it and I don't know all the details. I may be getting some of this wrong, but I do know of people who are doing that, and that's a possibility. And that's kind of getting back to this idea of how do we take this power and use it for more than finding the best smoothing plane? You know, mm-hmm. We want it to make our lives better, and that requires our data. And I guess that's an overarching theme throughout the show. But that isn't the only ones we've covered. The big ones here today, there's a lot of others, right? Adobe Firefly, which I've never touched. I don't know, Steven, you're an Adobe subscriber. Have you done much with it?
I have. It's similar to DALL-E, where you give it a prompt and it creates an image for you. But they also have it baked in to Photoshop. And I wrote a blog post a couple of months ago about that I'll have in the show notes, where you can use the AI tools to, like, extend a background or change part of an image. And they're working on video tools as well. Some of this is showing up, across Adobe's ecosystem. So their tools are more about creative generation, like generative AI, less about sort of asking the thing questions. But definitely interesting. And Adobe is definitely also thinking a lot about the legal side of it. So they have talked a lot about and done some work around metadata and images that have been modified with AI tools. And, like, there's a lot of work to be done there. Adobe is definitely part of that conversation, though. This episode of MPU is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one website platform for entrepreneurs to stand out and succeed online. Whether you're just starting out or managing a growing brand, you can stand out with a beautiful website, engage with your audience, and sell anything, products, services, even content, because Squarespace has everything you need, all in one place, all on your terms. Let's just talk about selling for a second. They have a bunch of really flexible payment options for you to put on your website. They're seamless, and it gives your customers lots of options. You can accept credit cards, PayPal, and Apple Pay. And in eligible countries, you can offer your customers the option to buy now and pay later with Afterpay and Clearpay. But designing a website can be kind of intimidating. With Squarespace Blueprint, it's really easy to get started. You choose from a professionally curated layout and styling options to build a unique online presence from the ground up, tailored to your brand or business and optimized for every device. Then you easily launch your website and get discovered fast with integrated, optimized SEO tools. So you show up more often and to more people, growing the way that you want. And you can use AI across your Squarespace site to kickstart or update written content, product descriptions, or emails, generating instant personalized results that know and show your brand identity. Explain what your site is about, choose your tone, and enter what you need to get short or long form text. No matter the placement, Squarespace AI makes it easy to go live, stand out, and succeed online. And I love that about Squarespace, that you have these tools not only to build a great looking website, but to make it successful. So all the SEO tools, the analytics, the AI tools, they all work together to make your website the best it can be. Head on over to squarespace.com/MPU to get started. You can get a free trial and you'll save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Again, squarespace.com/MPU to get 10% off your first purchase. Our thanks to Squarespace for their support of Mac Power users.
Okay, so we've been talking about the technology and the big players. Let's talk about some of our uses. We already shared a few, but I think starting with the basics is when you're talking to these things, how do you address it? You know, how do you become a good prompt generator? In fact, they have jobs now called prompt engineers where you can get paid just to figure out how to query artificial intelligence engines to give you good answers. One of the first things I would say to you, if you're new to this, is you can ask the machine how to generate a prompt. It's like, you know, help me figure out the best way to ask you this question, and it'll do it. You know, I think that's kind of shocking, but I read a bunch of different resources, and there's a lot of different approaches to this. So many people have made YouTubes telling you how to make your prompts, and there's so many articles on the web on it. I just broke it down to a couple points that I seems very common, and the first three are about accuracy, and the second three are about the quality of the answer result or what it looks like. So these are the points I would make. The first is you have to give it a task. You know, that's the first thing, is you have to ask it to do something for you. I'm asking it to summarize articles, or I'm asking it to convert this to Swahili or whatever, but you've got to give it a task. And then what you need to do is you need to refine that with context and exemplars. So you explain the context of the task, like what you're doing with it. And if you can give examples, that is hugely beneficial. I have found every time I created a prompt that had examples, I got exactly what I wanted. You were talking earlier about when you did the Apple Store code, you asked for, you gave it examples. And I think that is something a lot of people don't realize you can do and how much that improves the quality answer.
Yeah. And you kind of learn how to think like it in a weird way, like with those prompts. I remember when DALL-E and some of the other image generation tools came out, it became very clear that you could drastically change the outcome based on the input. So it's like, oh, I want a picture of a sunset with a dog in the foreground in the style of fill in the blank, right? Watercolor, yeah. Oil painting, Van Gogh, whatever you wanted. And again, there's ramifications there, especially on the art side, but giving it more is better most of the time. And again, the dream is like, it's more like what you said earlier, right? Like if I was wealthy and had a human assistant, right? I could tell that assistant, hey, you know, book lunch with John. Well, my assistant would know where we want to eat, who John is in the first place, right? Like the history of that relationship. These tools don't necessarily have all that yet. And so you kind of have to help it along a little bit more, but you kind of learn what works and what doesn't. But, you know, I think, again, going back to your example of explain an LLM in three paragraphs, make it simple. That's a great example. That's not super complex, right? You didn't write a paragraph, but you gave it some guidelines. And most of these tools, like I know ChatGPT and Perplexity are both this way. I'm sure others are as well. You can sort of correct it as you go. Like, oh, actually, let me sort of tweak a parameter. And it takes some practice, but you can really make it sing.
Yeah, like you could. And then that's the other three pieces of it, persona, format, and tone, where you can kind of craft exactly how the answer is delivered to you. Like you could say, you know, you are an expert certified public accountant with expertise in public companies, and I have some questions for you. You know, you can create like a virtual CPA. Now, would you file your taxes based on what that thing tells you? If you're not afraid of going to jail, I guess it'd be okay. But I mean, but what you want to do is just get yourself in the ballpark with this stuff. And you can create these kind of personas that give you an angle on a question that you wouldn't have otherwise. But it's really impressive. What I don't do with this stuff, though, I guess kind of getting into what we use it for, is I don't have it actually right for me. That's the one that everybody always talks about. You know, I think that's because I think the thing that got everybody wound up was that it was so good at writing college papers. And
yeah,
and that's a huge problem in academia. It's like, how do you deal with that? And I'm sure they'll figure something out. But I don't want it writing words for me. It's like, I feel like my words are my words. Mm-hmm. Like, I got so much time on this planet. If I publish something that was written by a robot, I just wasted time. You know, I mean, it's not my job to publish a robot's words. It's my job to publish my words. Like, to me, it's not even a question. I don't even know why I would want to do that, you know,
but for some people, it's the thing, right?
Yeah.
You and I think we both consider ourselves writers above everything else, even though my budget spreadsheet says that's not true. You know, we that's our way of doing things. But for a lot of people, that's huge, right? And it doesn't just have to be writing in the sense of I'm publishing an article or a memo, you know, to my staff that a robot has written. It can also be you know, sort of summarization. Like, there's other tools you can use here. Like, hey, here's a bunch of meeting notes. Like, Notion's AI does this. We're talking about them in a second. They're a sponsor, so take that as you will. But one of their tools is like, here's a bunch of meeting notes. Tell me what everybody said they were going to do and by when, right? Like, so that is in the realm of writing. And then, like, put that in, it's something I can email the team, right? So there are things beyond writing an essay. But I think that's the one people jump to. I think in particular because of the sort of the cheating that can go around, you know, in high schools and colleges, probably, you know, around these things. Clearly, that's a flashy example.
Yeah, well, I even gave it at one point because I pay for ChatGPT. You can make virtual GPTs. I said, read everything ever written at maxsparky.com because every word at that site and thousands of posts by me. And I said, read everything. And adopt the voice of David Sparks at Max Sparky. And then, you know, now write an article about this or that. And it's like, it didn't sound like me at all. You know? So I guess it's not very good at it. But to me, it's a point of pride. But you are right. I mean, there are writing things it does that I have played with. Like, we'll get to it in a minute, but I tried Spark Email's AI engine. And I did have it try to write a few email replies for me and things. So I guess it all depends. Maybe I'm being too strict here. But in general, I'm not particularly interested in it as a machine to write code for me or write words for me.
Same.
That would be something I'd publish. Like, my thoughts are my thoughts. I'd rather be express them myself.
Yeah.
However, it can do a ton with text. Like, you know, you can clean up text. You can translate text. Like, so often I've used it now to, like, take something I've written and just, like, you know, clean it up. Like, I had one where I needed to fix the subject verb. I had started writing about one thing. I ended up writing about multiple things. So I said, well, make a, you know, correct subject verb tense, you know, in this. And it did it, you know, and it was fine. And I could have done that by hand, but why not have the AI do it for you? It's just like dumb little monkey work. Have it do that stuff for you.
Mm-hmm. I think one thing that it can be particularly useful for, sort of in this creative realm, is ideation. So, if you know, coming up with a name for something, or hey, I've got this thing I need, you know, how could I talk about it in a new way or a different way? That can be really actually pretty compelling because it has all this information, it can make connections to other words or phrases or ideas that maybe I wouldn't. And again, I'm not going to post a blog post that it's written, but I could ask it, hey, you know, I write about these sorts of topics. What are some interesting blog posts that I could write? You know, that sort of thing. It's different than the writing. It's not that different, but it is pretty good. Like, I've heard, you know, on other podcasts and, you know, reading interviews with people who like create, like, yeah, we're using these tools to like help us come up with the title of the YouTube video or help us. Like, we have this idea. What are other ideas related to this that we could explore in the future? And that can be compelling and useful.
Absolutely. I have my roles-based productivity system, and like some of the titles of my roles are goofy and just dumb that I came up with years ago. I asked AI to come up with alternative names, and a couple of them I adopted. You know, it's just kind of, you know, that's kind of weird, but it worked.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing you can do with ChatGPT, if you have a paid version, is you can have like specific GPTs where they've got different public ones you can subscribe to, or you can build your own. And so I like they've got one called Universal Primer, which is like the idea is just to give you a basic understanding of any topic you ask it about. And they've got one that can generate diagrams. What I've been using, it's just kind of a personal thing, is I really like gardening, and there's one called Planty. And it's remarkably knowledgeable about any plant that I throw at it, and helps me figure out, you know, when am I going to prune the Chinese elm, you know? And so like, I find those, I like the idea of having like experts via GPT that can give me advice. And it's such so much easier just to ask it a question than to go to the web and try and track this stuff down. I mean, that's what it's doing for me.
No, I think those are great uses, and they are very similar to a lot of mine. I have not gone real far down the rabbit hole of like the custom GPTs with OpenAI, but you know, there's a world out there where like I give it everything in my dev and think, and it's like a very useful Apple history ChatGPT, because on its own is that's not very good at that. It has given me some hilarious things in the past. But you did a particular project. You had it on the blog and did a video for members. Tell us about that.
Yeah. I decided to build a virtual Seneca. Okay. So Seneca was a Roman kind of philosopher teacher, generally in the Stoic school, but he wrote a ton. And I've read a lot of his books over the years. I like him. He's got good practical advice that applies to the modern world in more ways than you'd think. So I've always been a Seneca fan, and I got thinking, well, what if I train ChatGPT on all of Seneca's writings? And so I made a video of it, and it's kind of a goofy thing. I did it almost more for fun. Well, I'll go ahead and share. This is usually just for Labs members. I'm going to put the link in the notes so you guys can watch it too. But I just went through and first trained it on the writings of Seneca. And I turned it into like a little virtual advice machine where you could ask it a question, and based on the writings of Seneca, it would answer you. And I recorded the whole process of building it, which was kind of informational, because you could see as it first started doing it, it was like very cold. The answers were very cold. I said, no, write your answer as if you were Seneca in his, you know, language. So all of a sudden it got way more flowery and more kind of epic in terms of the language being answered. And then I asked it a question. I said, my friend is marrying the wrong woman. What should I do? And it gave me advice based on you know, the writings of Seneca on how to handle that problem. And it was just kind of a fun experiment, but also shockingly good, you know, in terms of what it did. I did that for the video. Then, non-ironically, a few days later, we had another friend with a problem. And I said, well, what will virtual Seneca's tell me to do when I'm talking to this friend? And he gave me some good advice. So I thought it was kind of interesting.
Yeah, that's super fascinating, right? Because you're taking an existing body of work from an actual, you know, person who lived on the earth. You're feeding into a computer thousands of years later. And it's generating new content in that style. Like, just backing all the way up for a second, that's bananas. And it kind of seems like magic.
Yeah, it's totally weird. And at the end, I published it, you know, because they've got an option at GPT, like, do you want to just share this publicly? I'm like, yeah, I don't care. Because the source data was the public writings of Seneca. If I had like uploaded a bunch of my own PDFs and my own personal data, I would not have shared it. But you can make these either private or public. So I made it public. And that's kind of like the punchline of the video, is after I did that, I found out there were like 10 of them already. People had already had the same idea, you know. But but it was kind of a fun and interesting experiment and just an example of how this stuff can work. But to me, a lot of this feels like parlor tricks. It doesn't really matter until you get to your own data. Other things, though, I've done is I've been feeding it my Readwise highlights because I liberally highlight data out of Readwise. So I just take those and feed it in and say, okay, what are the key points of this book based on my highlights? So instead of saying, what are the key points of this book? Because, you know, maybe there were parts of the book I didn't think were interesting. It's going to read my highlights and then come back with me and I can have it give me a bulleted list or whatever, just kind of a summary. Because when I highlight a book, I highlight a lot of the book. I don't know what the limit is of how much you can highlight, but I think I'm pretty close. Because I treat the highlights as like the first pass, and then I go through and kind of distill them down. But I was using AI to try and figure it out for me. Another one is coding. Like you were talking earlier about what you did, but you know, people write us all the time and ask for Apple scripts to do this or that. ChatGPT is remarkably good at writing Apple script.
Which again, magical, right? It's not as old as Seneca, but it's not a young language.
In terms of programming languages, it is the Seneca equivalent.
Yeah. But it's not good at everything, right? I think kind of the biggest example most people have discovered, LLMs are pretty bad at math. You know, some of them have plugins or extensions that, you know, reach out to Wolfram Alpha or other tools, but asking most of these tools an algebra problem or even an arithmetic problem, it's going to struggle.
Yeah. Chess. It can't play chess. You know, if you play chess against ChatGPT, you might be able to beat it, you know, whereas a chess computer can do a better job of predicting the future. It's a completely different technology. And those things have not intersected, at least at this point, which is why that's the part that makes me wonder about the virtual assistant, like, because a good virtual assistant would predict what you're going to need and take care of it for you. And I'm not sure that these things are there yet.
Not quite. I think they could be, but not quite yet.
This episode of the MacPow Users is brought to you by Tailscale. Go to tailscale.com/MPU for secure remote access to shared resources. Tailscale is a programmable networking software that is private and secure by default, and it's the easiest way to connect devices and services to each other, wherever they are. It's super secure, providing remote access to production, databases, servers, Kubernetes, and more. And it's fast, like really fast. Plus, it grants privacy for everyone and every organization. Tailscale is an intuitive, programmable way to manage a private network, including a zero-trust network access that every organization can use. With Tailscale, you can build simple networks across complex infrastructures, use device posture management to granularly restrict access to resources based on a wide range of attributes like OS version, user location, and more, and save time with a trusted and proven networking solution that just works. But don't take my word for it. Check it out. Try Tailscale out for free for up to 100 devices and 3 users for free at tailscale.com/MPU. There's no credit card required. That's Tailscale, tailscale.com/MPU to try Tailscale for free for up to 100 devices and 3 users, no credit card required. And our thanks to Tailscale for their support of the Mac Power Users and all of Relay FM.
So we've talked about some of the big platforms and how we can use them, what they're good and bad at. But AI has also become a feature in a lot of software, especially in the productivity space. I feel like anytime a new app is announced or, you know, updated, it's like, oh, this now does this or that with AI. I know Spark Mail is something that you have played with and they've got some stuff in there. Maybe you want to start there?
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's got the standard AI tool set in the mail application where it will, like you can say, summarize this email for me, prepare a reply, or you can just give it a sentence, like a prompt, say, reply to tell them no because I'm busy and at a conference or something. And it will generate a response based on your basic information you give them that makes more sense and is in full and complete sentences. And that's an example of it writing for me. And I had to do that several times, and I was generally impressed with it. I do think that the answer with email and AI isn't what Spark is doing, you know, because that still requires me to read the email and figure out what the reply is. What I really want is it to go through and figure out like the three or four emails that I need to personally reply to, and then take all the rest and generate draft replies that I can review and send. And like, it takes no work from me except just to go through and review the drafts or something like that. I mean, to me, that's the future of this stuff and where it needs to be. But Spark is up there. You could still do this with something other than Spark. Like you could just draft, you could copy an email into a ChatGPT engine or one of the many apps that uses ChatGPT, and then say draft a reply that says this or that. But again, you know, when you're copying and moving text around and all this stuff, I'm not sure that it's really worth it.
Yeah. When the prompt is like longer than the email you would send, maybe you've crossed the threshold.
But the productivity end of email really is what I was talking about. It's like people out sometimes write me and they need like, they have a customer service problem with a field guide or something. Like an AI could read that email and understand it and use my directions back to the customer of how to reset it and send that back immediately, so they don't have to wait for me to read it, you know? And I feel like that's where this needs to go for email.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. Like, hey, if they're asking about these certain things, you know, just take care of it for me.
Yeah.
We mentioned Notion earlier. Notion is a sponsor of some Relay shows, even around their AI tools. But we're using Notion for the show. We did that before they renewed their sponsorship. And sponsorship, of course, doesn't affect our coverage here on Mac Power Users or any Relay show. But just to say it, Notion's AI tools are interesting. They have the sort of, you know, the standard tool set, like you mentioned with Spark. It can help me write. It can summarize a bunch of documents into bullet points. It can do the brainstorming thing, which I mentioned earlier. But it also has some tools that are a bit more specific to Notion. So a lot of work in Notion is around tables, right? So we have an MPU episodes table that has the titles, the dates, and then you click into, and that's sort of the outline, right? Lots of metadata. You and I really love metadata, and we cannot be stopped adding new fields to episodes in Notion. And it can look at that table and the other information in Notion and help fill that out for you. With like next steps or, you know, other types of common tasks you may do. And like Gemini and some of the others we've mentioned, it has access to your data, right? It's in your Notion account. And so you can ask it questions and it can pull data from multiple pages or multiple places scattered across your Notion account and then bring them together. It's something that you and I have both used in things like, when's the last time we talked about something, right? In the past, I'd have to like go to the Relay website and try to search it, or we have an archive page on the Relay website. It's like, well, maybe I can find it by title. I didn't have a great way of doing it. And that was even harder on a show like Connected, where the titles aren't descriptive of what the episode's about. But for both of my shows, I have their complete show note history imported into Notion now. So I can use its AI-powered search and help me find, when is the last time we talked about what's in our backpacks on MPU? Or when's the last time we talked about iPad Pro rumors on Connected, whatever it may be? And that has been really awesome for me, not only willing to reference past shows, making sure we don't repeat something. You know, we have some sort of standard shows we do on MPU, but we do them once every, you know, 1, 2, 3 years, right? We don't want to talk about our favorite iPhone apps every 6 months. And so that has been really useful. And I know something that you and I have both been doing.
Yeah. And like at Max Sparky, I have a separate Notion instance, and that one I pay for, and I have recently paid for AI too. This show has cost me a lot, gang. I, you know how sometimes we buy stuff. Yeah. After we record, I'm going to go through and look at all the services I'm paying for and audit which ones are going to stick around. But I'm sticking with AI on Notion because what we've been doing with all the Max Sparky stuff, because I do stuff to the labs and I do stuff to the blog and I've got all these different kind of channels. So what we've started doing is anything that goes out the door, the transcript goes into the document related to that thing. So we just use Mac Whisper, which is another AI tool. And we throw a video file or an audio file at it. It does a reliable transcript, which we dump into the document. And now I can say, well, how often have I talked about this app or that app? Or, you know, just finding trends and things that I'm doing to make sure we get new content out and we don't do the same stuff too much. And it's all using Notion AI to surface that for us. In fact, as you were talking, I was thinking we need to come up with a workflow for our show and start putting our transcripts into that Notion document, because that gives it even more data to work on.
Yeah.
But yeah, that is an example of the stuff that we've been talking about throughout the show, of using your data with AI to make your life easier.
Mm-hmm. I think an example of a tool that, you know, I feel like maybe just a little bit, they've sort of jumped on the AI bandwagon, even though they pre-exist sort of the current moment, is Grammarly, something that I think we both use. I know I definitely use it. I use it as a plug into the browser. I run blog posts through it. And it is basically a virtual editor. Now, I don't take all of its suggestions. You know, Grammarly sometimes like, rewrite the sentence. And it's like, well, no, I wrote it in a very particular way. Again, that's me and you being writers and kind of being precious about that. But boy, does it find grammatical errors and subject-verb disagreement. Or sometimes it does actually give me a good suggestion on how I could alter a sentence that I do follow. Grammarly's been around a long time. I think that it's, again, maybe a little bandwagony at the moment, but it is an extremely useful thing that, I mean, I've paid for Grammarly for years, and like I can't imagine like doing show notes in the browser, right? And the Relay CMS, it helps me make sure that I'm not doing something silly in an episode description. It has saved me a lot of pain over the years.
Yeah. And I feel like that's absolutely an AI tool, and they have a threat. Right. I mean, because as these big, you know, one of the questions is going to be, are we going to ultimately just have a service like ChatGPT and then plug our apps through it? Or are the apps going to be their own independent AI? Like, what if ChatGPT was just as good at grammar stuff as Grammarly?
Yeah.
Well, why would you pay for both? Right. You know, so Grammarly has focused on, well, we're going to go wherever you are writing and we're going to give you what you want. And we're going to, you know, and they're continuing to push the edge on these features because they realize that they're going to get wiped out if they aren't better than everybody else at grammar with AI. And I like it. I like that they feel the pressure, because I feel like the app, as much as I've always liked it, I feel like it's gotten even better over the last few years.
Same.
Keyboard launchers, Raycast and Alfred, are both using AI tools, but really what they're doing is usually you can plug in your API key to your ChatGPT account, and then you can kind of run it through there. And there's a bunch of like app front ends for this stuff. I have not really fallen in love with any of these implementations. When I do AI, I've just got a pin tab to ChatGPT and I go up there and do the AI stuff I need to do. And that's worked fine for me.
Me too. Yeah, I mean, in particular, Alfred, which is my launcher, there's a plugin, and yeah, exactly. You're giving it access to your account, and then basically you're just using the launcher as the initial prompt. And like you, I'll just do it in the web on the web, or on the iPhone or iPad in the official apps. Again, there are a lot of third party apps for a lot of these things. Use the official one, use the real one. But it is sneaking into all these tools, right? And I think in a lot of ways, they are, a lot of them are very similar, like especially around the text tools. But companies also, I think, can go too far with it. I wrote this blog post a couple weeks ago about Logitech's mouse software, including ChatGPT support. Like you can hit a button on your mouse. They even have new mice that have a dedicated ChatGPT button. I don't need that, right? And in fact, the way Logic did it was super janky on the Mac, and I called him out on it. But it can go too far, I think. And just like anything else that is a big deal or trendy, it will find level ground. But there is something I think different about this that I think this stuff is going to stick around. I don't think this is sort of the typical flash in the pan that sometimes we see out of Silicon Valley. This feels like a big moment in a way that I'm not sure I've felt in a while.
This isn't 3D television. This is this is here. And like we said at the beginning of the show, there are all sorts of societal impacts that are come from this that are going to be good and bad. And I just don't want to get into it here, honestly, because I think it's too heavy. But it's things you need to think about. But my big recommendation to you on this is find a way to make this stuff work for you and don't be afraid of it. I've heard from plenty of people who are like, well, I don't want to use that stuff because, you know, blah, blah, blah. No, you need to understand it. And if this is going to cause disruption, the people who understand it are the least likely to get disrupted. So go figure it out. And we've given you a lot of good recommendations today, but we got another part of this story here. What's next with this, right? Now that you and I have been playing with the tools available and we're heading into June, I mean, we've kind of picked the timing of the show because Apple hasn't made their big announcement yet, but they've all but promised that AI is going to be all over WWDC this year.
Mm-hmm.
What's going to happen next?
I don't know. I mean, they are talking about it, right? You mentioned earlier in the show, we didn't think Apple would use the language. They put it in the press release for the MacBook Air that it was the best consumer notebook for AI. I don't know what that means. Some people made fun of that comment, probably fairly. But it's clear that Apple is at work. They've got a lot of people, including some top people from Google and other companies that have joined Apple. There's a lot of research that happens in this area. So we're seeing a lot of papers and a lot of research coming out of Apple and people who work there about what they're doing. Episode 490 of Connected, I went deep into that, so I'll put that in the show notes. I think there's a big buckets here that Apple's working on. I think the one of the big ones is contextual support. So the model knowing what a user is looking at and doing on their device and bringing that context into the experience is something clear that they're interested in.
Yeah. And that kind of gets back to what I was saying. It's like Apple is in a unique position here because they, if the rumors are to be believed, they are coming up with a locally installed LLM or some sort of AI that's locally installed on your iPhone.
Yeah.
And what that means is, as a user, you don't have to worry about your data being spread across the internet because all of the computing is happening on your phone. It doesn't need to send the data up. I mean, all the stuff we've been talking about, I think virtually everything we talked about today involves sending your data to a server somewhere in order to perform that. And I'm not kidding myself. When I send a question to ChatGPT, I know that that's going to become part of their corpus, and they're going to build future versions on knowing that, you know, I asked this question and how do we do that better in the future? So they're really using that user data to improve everything, but they're also doing the processing up there. But that means they have the data.
Yep.
And if I had some secret, if I was still a lawyer and had a client secret, there's no way I could use this stuff. But if Apple does it and they can keep it local and they can promise us, hey, we're going to look at your contacts and your notes and your email and everything, but it's all never going to leave your iPhone. And we're going to use all that data locally on your iPhone to give you AI tools that make your life easier. Well, that to me is the answer that nobody has provided yet.
I think that's right. And I think clearly Apple wants to do this in their own way, on device as much as possible, private as much as possible. Now, with that said, Apple, if you believe the reporting, and I frankly do, that Apple is in talks with the likes of OpenAI to do some of this stuff with them or for them. You know, we don't know what that looks like yet, but clearly Apple is moving in this direction like its competitors. You know, we've mentioned Microsoft it being baked into 365, which is a huge deal. Google's done stuff on Android. A lot of their AI tools are on the Pixel, and some of them are on Samsung phones as well now. Things like photo imaging or photo, you know, editing and correction, some tech stuff. Apple's going to be moving in all those directions, and their research includes a lot of that stuff too. They have some papers out about editing images through text prompts, right? Like, I took a picture of my wife, but oh no, there's a you know, a tree in the background I want to get rid of, help me do that on my phone or on my Mac. I think a lot of Apple tools are going to be similar to what we've seen, but I do think they'll be sort of Apple flavored in a way.
Yeah. In fact, those papers, because there's so many of them that are photo related, you have to guess that whatever they announce is going to have some interesting AI and photos. But, you know, what I'm most interested in is, like I keep saying, make this virtual assistant to me. And as I read the paper titles, none of them really refer to that. Mm-hmm. So maybe I'm going to be disappointed. But I do think, you know, being Apple, they're going to incorporate it in small ways. It's not, I would be surprised if it's just like an open-ended ChatGPT style LLM, write a question to me, you know. I feel like it's all going to be more focused in on specific features, with the idea that, you know, we've got a huge user base and people want to be able to use this stuff. We don't want to have to teach them to be prompt engineers to use it, you know.
Yeah.
What do you think Apple will bring AI to? What are some of the possible ideas?
I think a really obvious one is code completion and troubleshooting in Xcode. We mentioned GitHub and Copilot earlier on. Apple writes their own IDE in Xcode. They are in charge of their own languages, so Objective-C and Swift, and their own frameworks and their own APIs. And that seems like a really straightforward, not to say that it's easy, but it seems like a pretty straightforward solution that Apple would bring those tools into Xcode for developers. I think in particular, that's exciting for people getting started, right? You think about Swift Playgrounds, and like Swift and Swift UI are designed, for better or for worse, to be really approachable. And it would be even more so. I think it'd be even easier for people to get into it if an AI tool can come alongside them and help them with their coding projects.
Yeah. I mean, another obvious candidate is Siri. You know, Siri, which we've made fun of so many times on the show, I think it could be a lot smarter if it had more AI built into it.
I think in addition to Siri, I think Spotlight, you know, the two things are so the same thing, but not the same thing. I think there's a branding question there. But hey, yeah. I have all this information on my device. Help me find it better. Some things we've seen from Apple, like in photos, like people detection, pet detection, object detection, you know, more of that sort of stuff, better examples of that. You know, Apple has called that sort of thing machine learning in the past. Machine learning, artificial intelligence, I think for the purposes of this conversation are basically interchangeable. From a consumer standpoint, I think they definitely are interchangeable. And, you know, supercharging these technologies they already have in addition to building on new ones. I mean, in a way, they've already shipped a huge thing in iOS 17, in Sonoma, et cetera. The keyboard prediction is based on large language model. They call it a transformer model. That's what the T in GPT stands for.
Yeah, that's back before they were afraid to say AI.
Yes. Yeah. Now they would say, oh, it's the keyboard with AI. And so if you're typing and it starts auto-completing more and more text ahead of you, that's what that is. You know, it's not perfect, but it's gotten pretty good. I feel like there's a lot of times where I just let the autocomplete do what it wants to do because it's what I was going to do anyways. And that was not always the case with Apple's autocomplete.
Yeah, and I would argue that the voice-to-text, I believe they said, had some transformer. I think they didn't say AI, but that got a big upgrade last year too. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that's AI behind that. Another one, you wrote down in the outline, and new AI features for Messages app that can auto-complete messages, answer questions, and summarize incoming text messages. That makes total sense to me, but I would argue that they should do that for Apple Mail too. That
yes.
We should get like the Spark kind of options in Apple mm-hmm. Mail too.
100%. It should be in Mail. It should be in things like calendar and reminders. I think maybe the lowest hanging fruit here, honestly, is Pages, Keynote, and Numbers. So give me those text tools, but also help me, you know, if I need an image generated or I have an image, right? And I say, oh, actually, I want this and this changed about it. Like having those built into their first party apps makes a lot of sense. I fully expect iWork, you know, Pages, Keynote, Numbers in particular, to get some real attention this year in this arena.
But I don't expect this this first version to be, you know, mission complete kind of implementation. I think it's going to take some time, but I do think we're on the verge of maybe taking back some of what technology has taken from us in terms of productivity. Like, I feel like in a lot of ways, technology has let us down for productivity because so often it becomes so much about managing the tech and the lists and all this stuff. You spend so much time fiddling with these things. I think AI could hopefully allow us to offload some of that to the AI where we're not manually managing those parts of our life as much anymore. And we have more time to focus on what's important. So this could be a really good turning point in terms of overall productivity.
I think so too. And that's how I try to look at this. Like, yes, there are negative there are downsides, there are ramifications to this. But I think in the most optimistic perspective is exactly what you said. Like, hey, can this make what I do better, more efficient, so I'm not spending, you know, all day in my inbox or all day, you know, wherever I may be. Let me get back to what I'm good at. And that seems to be the goal, I think, for a lot of these companies, honestly. And I think that's how Apple is going to pitch this. You know, I thought just as much about what Apple is going to do and how they're going to talk about it. Because here's a little secret. How Apple talks about something can be very revealing about the decisions that went into what they're talking about. Yeah. And I expect that Craig Federighi, whoever's on stage at WWDC, or maybe this iPad event, which we're going to talk about, and more power users, when they're talking about these things, they're going to talk about it, I think, in terms of efficiency and in terms of empowering users. Not, oh, well, you don't need a graphic designer anymore because you have Midjourney built into your phone, right? I think that's how they're going to talk about it. I think Apple's at its best when it empowers its users. And I really believe they can use these tools to further that mission. Will it be perfect on day one? Absolutely not. Will there be headlines when one of Apple's AI tools does something incredibly stupid? Like there was a lot of issues around Gemini's image creation in the beginning. Someone was asking for like historical photos and it really did some like terrible things. That is probably going to happen. Like, just brace yourselves. Like, this summer in beta and this fall when these things roll out, you know, assumedly, there will be cases where this stuff falls on its face in a way that is very un-Apple-like. They're going to do the best they can to guard from those things, but it's going to happen. And that's just part of this world, I think.
Interns make mistakes.
Exactly.
All right. We want to thank our sponsors today, 1Password, Squarespace, and Tailscale. We are the Mac Power Users. You can find us over at relay.fm/MPU. Hey, if you'd like, you can sign up for More PU. There you go. More Power Users. That's the extended ad-free version of the show. Today on that extended version, Steve and I are going to be talking about the upcoming iPad event. We'd love to see you there. Either way, have a great week, everybody, and we'll see you next time.